I will thank you for coming. I'm John Marty. I'm a state senator in Minnesota, and obviously the U.S. Department of Peace is not in my bailiwick. I cannot affect federal government that way. We try at times, but they more have ability to crush us and their ability to do things. Anyway, this session is titled, Why Don't We Have a U.S. Department of Peace? And the notes prepared for it said, whether it's a Cold War or a war on terror or some other threat, our national response is to build up the military-industrial complex, and our aid to other countries is often selling them more sophisticated military hardware. World tensions increase, and we are one tragic misstep from nuclear war. When I wrote these notes back in March or so, I was thinking maybe there'd be nuclear war between us and North Korea. That seems to have gone off the table, fortunately. Unfortunately, the idea of promoting peace and understanding through humanitarian and development assistance and through diplomacy doesn't even get lip service from politicians. But we would be safer with a different approach, and this is designed to take a look at the politics of war and peace and the idea that we need a new approach to security and world peace. In looking at warfare and peace issues, I think it's important that we take a look at human psychology, human emotions, because international conflicts are between people or peoples. And I suggest that there are two important realities we realize. First of all, we are in a very brutal world. People can do, and they do develop incredible hatreds for each other, and they use that hatred to do unspeakable things to each other. And that's not new. It's not, ISIS is not new in that sense. It's been happening throughout history, things we think are unimaginable. And each time they happen, we vow never again. And after Germany, after World War II, the never again, no more genocide, no more of that. I think when you see the hatreds building in many countries in Europe and in our own country, you worry that it could happen again. But one reality is that very extremely brutal world, and the other one is that we have a very caring humanity. People can and do love and care about each other. They use that love to make incredible sacrifices, even for people they've never met, even people who are different than them. And I say those two realities because I think our international relations, not just the U.S., we perhaps worse than some others, but they're based on, we recognize that first reality, the brutal world, but we don't always recognize the other one. As a result, we understand we have wars. If people are brutal, we're going to fight back, we're going to do it. Sometimes those wars may be for what seem to be noble purposes. Obviously, World War II and the fight against fascism, but sometimes it's for very difficult to fathom reasons. World War I mean, you can read the history books, you can read the understanding of it, and you think that was worth killing that many million people over. And so there are times when one might say a war, well, the whole debate over if there's just war and so on. But certainly wars have some of which you can't even understand why there ever was a war in the first place. Why do we need a new approach? Well, I will quote Martin Luther King. This is 1963 or so. He said, we must find an alternative to war and bloodshed. Anyone who feels, and there's still a lot of people who feel this way, that war can solve the social problems facing mankind. They're sleeping through a great revolution. President Kennedy said on one occasion, and I think this is actually an Albert Einstein quote originally, mankind must put an end to war or war will put an end to mankind. The world must hear this, King says. I pray God that America will hear this before it's too late. And he also said, it's no longer a choice, my friends, between nonviolence and violence. It's either nonviolence or non-existence. So I wanted to start this session by talking not about the broader peace and military thing, but about nonviolence, first of all, as an approach, and nonviolence in international era, not just nonviolent protests against immigration policy or other things, but nonviolence in a frightful world. And this session is not primarily about nonviolence, but it does clearly play into it and how we resolve conflict. And the first thing I'd say about it is that nonviolence works. And I say that because there are a lot of people who are convinced it doesn't. And I think part of the reason they do that is because whenever you have nonviolent protests in a military situation, some of those nonviolent protesters get killed. They're standing up there against tanks in Tiananmen Square. They're standing in many cases in Philippines, in Moscow, standing up against tanks, standing up to people with guns, and they're totally unarmed. And you know if somebody shoots the gun or whatever, they're going to be dead people, and that happens. And so it's an unrealistic expectation, I'd argue, that to say if we act peacefully, then the brutes will drop their weapons and act peacefully as well. It's not that simple, and it's naive to think because you're unarmed, the other side will be too. Mahatma Gandhi and others said that courage was the number one most difficult thing you have to have for nonviolent defense. And the thing is, when people say, but that's proof it doesn't work, I think the first thing to say is, you know, nonviolent protesters who are standing up there who might get killed, they're doing nothing different in terms of the risk to their lives that armed soldiers are doing. They also risk getting killed, and many do get killed. If getting killed by practicing nonviolence means nonviolence is a failure, then war is a failure as well, because a lot of military people get killed when they're armed and fighting with them. And if losing a battle through nonviolence, which definitely happens, sometimes it happens for decades at a time, who is it, Vaclav Havel said, they quoted him many times, that why did he keep fighting in Czechoslovakia in the 1960s? He said he would just would arrest them and they'd spend several years in prison, then they'd go out and they'd protest again, and they'd get arrested again, and they'd do the same cycle again over many years. Why do you keep doing it? And he said, well, you have to believe, you have to have some hope that things can change, and if you do have hope, you keep doing it. And if losing is something that shows nonviolence doesn't work, well, so is war, because there are lots of people who fight hard, they actually win battles, but lose wars. So if the arguments that nonviolence doesn't work because people die, it's a dangerous thing to do, or because it fails, well, then war is the same failure. And sometimes, I mean, during the 1930s and 40s, India's nonviolent struggle ended up in tens of thousands of people dying. Algeria in the 1950s, its fight for free independence from France, it was a military fight, and there were a million people killed, like 1 in 10 people there. Both of them eventually succeeded. India got its independence, Algeria got its independence. It was hundreds and hundreds more lives lost in the Algerian fight than in the Indian one. Both of them had the same outcome. If you are going to have nonviolent protests, how does one find people willing to risk their lives and risk their lives being unarmed? And again, people who are armed are also putting their lives as somehow they feel, because I got some weapon to fight back, I'm safer, but realistically, they may not be. William James in 1910 wrote an essay called The Moral Equivalent of War, and I'm going to quote here, "The war against war is going to be no holiday." And he said those seeking to promote war have to recognize that war draws out many noble traits in people: loyalty, self-sacrifice, courage, willingness to face death, discipline, and dedication. And James says, nonviolent alternatives cannot succeed with any less effort and the need to offer an alternative in the use of those noble traits. In other words, he's saying you're going to have to call people to their best instincts, to self-sacrifice, to courage, incredible courage, that most of us may not have. Walter Wink, the theologian, said there's a whole host of people simply waiting for the Christian message to challenge them for once to a heroism worthy of their own lives. But, you know, okay, so we're going to get a few people who are peace activists, and so maybe they're willing to sacrifice their lives, maybe they're willing to do this. What about people who didn't grow up in that tradition? What about people who were in a different one? And I wanted to talk about one of the incidents, we know so little about history and history of nonviolence, history of things like that, doesn't often get written. It's not as glamorous as discussing strategic military battles and so on. But Ron Sider, who wrote, he's the founder of a group called Christian Peacekeeper Teams, Christian Peacemaker Teams about 30 or 40 years ago, Mennonite tradition folks and so on. He wrote about an episode, he says, in the episode of nonviolent intervention, no episode is more astonishing than that of Badshah Khan and his nonviolent army of 80,000 Muslim Pathans. Pathans lived in the strategic Khyber Pass, the northwest gateway to India from Afghanistan and Russia. The British who tried to subdue them considered the Pathans the most savage, brutal warriors they had ever met. Pathans' strict code of revenge obligated them to avenge the slightest insult. For a Pathan, quote, the surest road to paradise was to die, quote, with his rifle smoking. India's future Prime Minister Nehru commented that the Pathan male loved his gun better than his child or brother. When Badshah Khan persuaded the Pathans to adopt nonviolence, even Gandhi was amazed. That such men, Gandhi exclaimed, who would have killed a human being with no more thought than they would kill a sheep or a hen, should, at the bidding of one man, have laid down their arms and accepted nonviolence as the superior weapon, sounds almost like a fairy tale. But they did. Badshah Khan was a Pathan Muslim who had become enthralled with Gandhi's vision of nonviolent struggle. Khan began to dream of an army of nonviolent soldiers directed and disciplined with officers, cadres, uniforms, a flag. Calling his volunteers the servants of God, Khan organized the first professional nonviolent army. They marched in drill, wore a special uniform, red shirt. They developed careful organizational structure complete with officers and a bagpipe corps. They also worked in the villages, opened schools, maintained ordered public gatherings. His nonviolent army was ready when Congress Party issued its historic declaration of nonviolence in the struggle for Indian independence in 1929. In April 1930, when the Great Salt Campaign began, this is a fairly lengthy thing, but I think this is a story worth reading. The British government monopolized the sale of salt and taxed it, with Gandhi in the lead. Millions of Indians broke the salt laws, illegally buying and selling millions of pounds of salt. The British response was brutal. Soldiers beat unarmed protesters with steel-tipped staffs. They raided the offices of the Congress Party. 100,000 Indians landed in jail. Nowhere was the repression as bad as in Badshah Khan's home in the strategic northwest frontier. When he called his Pathan people to nonviolent resistance, he was quickly arrested. Nonviolent civil disobedience promptly broke out everywhere among the Pathan. Bayonets and bullets were the British response. One bloody afternoon, they killed over 200 unarmed protesters and wounded many more. British brutality evoked massive support for the Pathans. In a very short time, his nonviolent army swelled to 80,000 volunteers. Fearing this Pathan nonviolence even more than their former savagery, the British did everything to destroy the red shirts and provoke them to violence. They ordered them to strip naked in public, beat them into unconsciousness when they refused. After public humiliation, many were thrown into pools of human excrement. Everywhere, the British hunted Badshah Khan's nonviolent army like animals, but the proud Pathans remained firmly nonviolent. Throughout the rest of Indian nonviolent struggle, which many of us are more familiar with, and the brutal repression raged throughout 1930, finally at the end of the year, British government summoned Gandhi to arrange a truce. It was the first time British recognized and negotiated with his nonviolent movement. For the next decade and a half, Badshah Khan and his nonviolent red shirts played a key role in the battle for independence. He was working for peace and reconciliation. 1948, when thousands died in Hindu-Muslim violence, 10,000 of Khan's servants of God, remember these are Muslim folks, protected Hindu and Sikh minorities in the northwest frontier, eventually restored order in the large city of Peshawar. Anyway, Khan's biographer wrote, if Badshah Khan could raise a nonviolent army of people so steeped in violence as Pathans, there's no country on earth where it could not be done. And Badshah Khan asked Gandhi why his Pathan people grasped the idea of nonviolence more quickly than the Hindus. Gandhi responded, nonviolence is not for cowards. It's for the brave, the courageous, and the Pathans are more brave and courageous. I say that, it's a very long story. Maybe some of you have heard that before, but people known for their brutality are able to be turned into a nonviolent army, and of course, the British attempts to provoke them to violence we got to show that they're not really nonviolent because they were breaking up the heart, hitting the hearts and men, minds of people. Why does this nonviolent approach work? And I'd argue that counter to that, why does violence not work? At least I'd argue in the long run. And here, and I'm only readings here are in this part about nonviolence. And this is a part about, many of you recall in the Philippines in the 1980s, Corazon Aquino, who later became the president, her husband, Benigno Aquino, was a Philippine member of the Philippine Senate who had been imprisoned many times for his fights and so on. He in prison became convinced by Christ and Gandhi that nonviolence was the approach you ought to take. Released in 1980 to obtain heart surgery, he prepared himself for that moment's return. And he spoke about his nonviolence thing in some testimony before U.S. House of Representatives in 1983. And this is shorter, but I'm just going to read little bits of his testimony. To gather empirical data and firsthand information, I traveled to the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and Central America. I interviewed the leaders of most successful revolutions and talked to both the victors and the vanquished, the relatives of the victims and the survivors. I've concluded that revolution and violence exact the highest price in terms of human values and human lives in the struggle for freedom. In the end, there are really no victors, only victims. I decided to pursue my freedom struggle through the path of nonviolence, fully cognizant this may be the longer and more arduous road. I've chosen to return to the silence of my solitary confinement and from there to work for peaceful solution to our problems rather than go back triumphant to the blare of trumpets and cymbals seeking to drown the wailing and sad lamentations of mothers whose sons and daughters have been sacrificed to the gods of violent revolution. Can the killers of today be the leaders of tomorrow? Must we destroy in order to build? I refuse to believe it's necessary for a nation to build its foundation on the bones of its youth. His return to the Philippines, he was going to expect him to go back to prison, and he was assassinated as he got off the airplane by some of Marcos' folks, taking him out of commission. And again, that was 1983, and the overthrow of the Marcos government took 3 more years, a lot of violence in the meantime. But I wanted to read the final reading I'm going to take here, also in the same, battle. One of the observers at the end of the fight said, people were willing to die, but not to kill. I thought, even if some people, soldiers, were willing to shoot the people, they were not willing to shoot the crucifixes. Remember, the Philippines is a strong Catholic community. The bishops actually spoke up many times in favor of the folks trying to have nonviolent struggle. Many of them were from provinces where they were raised to fear God. They could never shoot people who were praying. They could have shot people who were throwing stones as they did during the rallies, but this was the first time they were confronted with prayers. They did not know how to react. I think this was crucial to the whole nonviolent stance. And the priest named Jose Blanco, the founder of a Philippine revolutionary group, a nonviolent revolutionary group, said the world's problems are best solved. This is sort of his philosophical comment on it. World's problems are best solved if we respect the humanity, the dignity of every person concerned. The desire to be violent or use violence can be tamed and diminished if we show love, care, joy to those who are unjust and wish to be violent. Violence addresses the aggressor. Nonviolence searches out and addresses the humanity in the enemy or oppressor. When that common humanity is touched, the other is helped to recognize the human person within and ceases to be inhuman, unjust, and violent. And that's sort of a summary of how it works. When you stand up, when you have people, Martin Luther King bringing children, when they had the Birmingham police sending fire hoses and dogs on children, it awakened, people were horrified at it. People said only so much could they take. And it changed opinions. The civil rights battle was not fought with guns. It was fought against people who had guns, and lots of civil rights activists, nonviolent people, many of them were killed. So again, the whole point earlier that just because somebody may get killed through nonviolence doesn't mean it doesn't work, means like a soldier in another war with a gun may get killed as well and still may lose. So nonviolence, in my summary of it, is nonviolence works. It may be deadly, it may require incredible courage, but even violent people can be won over by that. And if you need to see that, there are certainly many, many times in history where there is evidence of people happening. I think you can say it certainly happened in the overthrow of Marcos and in Gandhi's in India. You could also say it in Poland in solidarity. I think in many ways the Iron Curtain thing, South Africa, Nelson Mandela's 100th birthday is, I think, this week. Tiananmen Square, the person standing up the tanks, and every one of these things except Tiananmen Square, they were ultimately successful. Nonviolent revolutions. But again, this is not a talk primarily about nonviolence, but about how we structure our international relations. But I think it's important to see that there are multiple ways, because of the inherent cruelty in people and the inherent kindness in people, how you appeal to them and how you react to them has a big impact. So if you keep those things in mind, how do we deal with international relations? The two approaches, the military option, which we've chosen and been following, is to build the biggest, most awesome military, best technology, and we're going to crush them like ants. Last 2 years ago, the presidential debate, when they were talking about bombing people to bits, including their whole communities, their families, and everything, it was it's a military talk that wins elections in some cases. It's a military talk that fires people up. But the nonviolent conflict resolution that wins hearts and minds not only can, in some cases, change people through nonviolent action, but the diplomacy part of this is maybe up front, not when you're in the battle, not when you're the person standing up against the person with the guns. And we're spending literally trillions of dollars a decade in terms of armaments. The U.S. spends almost as much as every other nation in the world spends in military spending. And so we're way far, far ahead of China, Russia, all of our allies and our opponents. We spend far more than that. Our Department of Defense used to have, I'd argue, a more accurate name. It was the Department of War, which actually is what they're good at. They fight wars. And defending ourselves, I think you can argue a whole lot of things they do are not in defense of our nation. Yet we have no Department of Peace, nothing on the other side. This year, the last 2 years, our State Department, which is our diplomacy, what people might argue should be seen as a Department of Peace, it's been heavily downsized. We have a lot of career diplomats retiring, and the chaos there is not good because a lot of those folks have been 30 years of building relationships and so on, and now having many of them retire and having our State Department stripped down, we're basically saying, well, we're going to take one approach to the rest of the world, and that's military approach. Many Americans think we're very generous with our foreign aid per capita. We're very low down on the among nations in terms of how much we commit to other countries. And the question is this approach making things safer? After 9/11, that's now 17 years ago, remember how in the days after, how many nations of the world, ones that weren't even our allies, were sending notes of sympathy, saying, what can we do to help? We feel so bad about this. We had the whole world trying to help us, being our allies. We want to join you and so on. And in 17 years, we've made it so most of the world hates us more than ever. And we've done some things in terms of the way we, if they torture people, we can torture people, which I don't think there's been a more articulate spokesperson against that than John McCain, who in the recent confirmation of the new CIA chief was saying that he's not saying she's not a good person, not saying she's not an effective person, but her unwillingness to stand up to the torture when she was in a place where she could. disqualifies her from that. And he, I think he's been very clear that our nation always built its prestige, its moral authority, because we didn't do those same things. And now for us to be trying to make excuses on how we do, it hurts. I mean, one of the things he said is somebody who's been tortured himself. He said that those things simply justify the actions of the other side. The same way that we use their hateful actions to justify our torture, they use our torture and our treatment of other people to justify whatever they want to do to us. And fundamentally, as you win one war, you're creating the next generation of warriors. And I'd say the best illustration of that in history is probably after World War I, when all the Allies went in and stepped in and said, we're going to make Germany pay. And they crushed Germany, and who was it, U.S., blanking on the name of U.S. diplomat who warned, he said, if you imagine, it was very prescient about what happened 30 years later, he said, if we do this to them, they will come back fiercer and more nasty than ever. And when you read this after World War II, you think, why didn't anybody listen to it? We punished them to the point their economy collapsed and a hateful person was able to do it. So creating enemies like that is not helpful. Another more, what it means on a one-on-one basis, not a treatment of an entire nation, but when you look at people, when you see, when a child sees their parents killed by an American bomb in front of their eyes, I mean, what's that child going to grow up to think? I mean, we can say, well, we didn't mean to kill them. Well, whether we meant to or not, that's what they see. And in the each time more horrific things happen with Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram or ISIS, each time more very hateful things happen, we want to respond more viciously, and they use whatever we do and certainly magnify it and make it look worse and so on. So I'd say that the individual case of what happens when a child sees their parents being killed, we're creating enemies as fast as we can destroy them. I want to talk for a couple minutes too before going to the nonviolent approach, is to talk about the just war concept, which has been around since Augustine proposed it many, many centuries ago. And they always say the first requirement of a just war is that all other alternatives have been exhausted. And Ron Sider, the theologian I quoted earlier, asked, how can Christians in the just war tradition claim the violence they justify is truly a last resort until they've invested billions in training tens of thousands of people in a powerful, sustained testing for the possibilities of nonviolent alternatives? He's in effect saying, we haven't tried any of those things, so how can you say any war is justified because we haven't done those steps first? So, turning to the nonviolent approach, the conflict resolution, or I'd argue conflict prevention approach, the thing that in the Vietnam War we almost naively thought we were trying to win the hearts and minds of the people who we were losing the more we did. But how do you do that? Well, first thing I'd argue, and this is not necessarily winning over people as allies, but stop selling armaments. We sell armaments to India, we sell them to Pakistan, we sell them to countries fighting against each other. For business reasons, we sell them, and we are the nation, the world's number one arms seller. We make good money doing that, but keep thinking we're arming people. I mean, a lot of the stuff in Afghanistan, a lot of the folks, Al-Qaeda folks, who armed them in the first place? We did, because we were helping them fight against the Soviet Union back 20 years earlier. So the first thing we should do is stop selling the arms. But the goal is to create friendship by, prevent conflict by building friendship and trust. And along with that, you teach the nonviolent approach to things. There are certainly some non-governmental NGOs, nonprofit groups that are working in this. First thing I'd say is there are thousands of nonprofits who are working in international aid and development. Lutheran World Relief, UNICEF, there are Doctors Without Borders, there are thousands of groups. And the fact that we mentioned it briefly doesn't mean that they don't have one of the most important roles in building a peaceful world, because they do. But just to say that they're out there, and we should never forget how important their work is. But there are also even a few NGOs that work specifically in violence prevention. I'll name two of them, one of which I mentioned earlier, the Christian Peacemaker Teams. They've been in Israel-Palestine. We actually met some people there 20 years ago. They've been in First Nations fights in Canada. They've been in Colombia. They've been around the world in various conflict resolutions, and they basically walk with people. They're unarmed. They will walk with Palestinian children to school when they're walking past people throwing stones at them. And I think they're very clearly trying to say, we don't want anybody on either side using violence. And it's impressive. He said, why can't we create this nonviolent army of people, in a speech 30 years ago, and they created, I think their teams are 10 people or so, and they have people who serve overseas in these teams for 2-3 years, and they have volunteers who go there for 6-week things and so on. Another one, a Minnesota-based one, it was founded in Minnesota, but a nonviolent peace force, where they were trying to do, actually create an army, they actually have a board now. Most of their board members are from third world countries. But in Sri Lanka, they were just trying to put themselves between the two warring factions, which is a very dangerous place to be. And these groups do lose lives for people who are trying to prevent violence, but you have to sense when you see the situations that they've prevented other violence and maybe have prevented wars. But why should it be just non-profit, non-governmental groups doing this? The UN has not been able to do much, and they, in most cases, are armed. Why not, at the governmental level, try and do something? That's where I argue the U.S. Department of Peace would make sense. Part of their effort would be related to the diplomacy of the State Department and promoting the State Department's diplomacy, not working, fighting against efforts to cut it and so on. It might also involve things like development aid, like the Peace Corps. Kennedy, in the early 1960s, when the Peace Corps was started, you get idealistic young people who want to make a difference. And in the years that have passed, there are lots of idealistic people of every age, retirees and others who devote a couple years to Peace Corps. And you can't measure, there's not been a violent episode there, or this didn't happen. But you can't prove it, but we do know the way human nature works. The more kindness you show to somebody, the better it works. Martin Luther King, the thing I was quoting from him earlier, he talked about how we spend far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. Play on words, but basically saying we want to create understanding and concern for others, and whether it is a Peace Corps type of thing, whether it is those nonprofit organizations doing it, the best thing you can do is educate and train others. But we've been more and more of our development assistance is going not to places where the needs are greatest, but where we have our allies or people we want to reward or something. And bottom line, the part of that that I'd say can help make the biggest difference would be to recognize after World War II. Again, we took Germany, our worst enemy, and for 60-some years, they've been one of our best allies. How did we do that? Well, unlike what happened after World War I, we took a different approach. The Marshall Plan, what if we tried to take, that was several billion dollars in today's budgets, but when we're talking $600-700 billion in defense spending, a few billion dollars in the new global Marshall Plan might do wonderful things. And the whole idea of bringing a peaceful approach to military conflicts is not that it's easy. Again, as we were talking about the nonviolence, it's not an easy thing to get people to do. It requires a lot of courage, but the same thing requires making an investment. And if we're going to shift military aid to development and education, nonviolence, peace building, that makes sense. And to get back to the idea of just war theory, if the just war theory requires that you must exhaust every other alternative before war becomes just, that would sort of mean that instead of Department of Peace having a little budget, if you'd almost think we'd have to have a bigger budget than the U.S. Defense Department in order to say we're really taking this seriously. And again, that's a huge change in thinking, but the way we're building war doesn't work. And I want to open it up for discussion and comments and ideas that people have had on this. But I want to, before I close, I wanted to say something I think will surprise people, a little bit ironic perhaps, and it's about somebody who I don't care to say anything good about because it's a real problem. I mean, he's the antithesis of everything we're talking about here, but Donald Trump. He's preached hatred and division. He's tried to build antagonisms between people. He's the exact opposite we're trying to do here, which is why I say it's so ironic. About 3 months ago, I don't know, maybe nobody else was, but I was very worried we have two nutcases talking about meeting with each other, people were calling each other insults, and then we could have war with North Korea, and then he says he's going to have a summit. And after the summit, it was widely panned as a bad idea. One Reagan administration official I heard on TV talk about, Ronald Reagan would never have done something like this. He gave up so much without getting anything other than some hollow words back from the North Korean government, which we know are no good because they're never any good. And I'm thinking, he said, none of these, either party, no president would do this. Clinton, Obama, Bush, the other Bush, Reagan, none of them would do this. They were not going to do, well, what did he give away? Well, he said, not as part of the agreement, but he just said, we're going to stop, unilaterally, we're going to stop our joint military exercises with South Korea, which had always been kind of poking a thumb at North Korea and North Korea's eyes. Rightly or wrongly, it's clearly seen that way. If it's not intended that way, it's at least seen that way. What else did he give them? Well, we haven't given them the dignity to recognize, to have them talk to the most powerful nation on the planet. We will not have many previous presidents that we're not going to have direct negotiations with them. We're not going to dignify them with that. But I also say, you know, despite that, you know, we've been having, the last 30 years, we've been having North Korea continuing to build up its military threat. It's still there. It hasn't changed yet. But 6 months ago, we were talking about who's got the bigger, well, we've got the more vicious nuclear thing, and boy, they'll be horrified. We hope we'll never have to use that against them. We'll, I don't care if theirs is 1/10,000th as big as our nuclear arsenal. I don't want them using that on anybody either. And the fact that you have two people who I think many would question the mental stability of them and so on, throwing rocks at each other is very dangerous. And so here they sit down and I'm thinking, well, you know, the worst that came out of it is he gave up some things that didn't get anything for. And North Korea said some things. We don't know if we can trust them, but the harm of talking with each other. And I guess I'd say that this is a good illustration of how we are so intent on making sure we don't give up something, our strategic negotiations. You know, if they decide they had to do these military exercises jointly, I'm not sure that that's a good idea in the first place, but if they had decided to, they could always go ahead and do them again. But what did he give up? Well, he said, we're willing to talk with you. And it's so uncharacteristic of everything else he does, but even Reagan administration people said, we would never have done that. But that may be the way you do it. You get people who, the most improbable people, start talking with each other and treating each other as human beings. That's sort of what the whole approach has to be. And saying, it doesn't always work. Yeah, and none of the other things we've tried in North Korea have worked either. So with that, I'm going to open it up for discussion and questions, comments, examples, things you've seen, and so on. So, yes?
Yes, so the case of Korea, we were directly involved. Mm-hmm. But could you explain, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but could you explain what our stance should be in regard to places like Syria, Yemen, South Sudan, where we are not directly involved,
right,
even though we would like to be if we could do something worthwhile. How should we approach it from your point of view?
And I'm not trying to be, I'm not trying to pretend to be a strategic, someone who would be able to comment on that, other than to say that in Syria, you know, I do think when we say, oh, there's this line we will not cross, you use chemical weapons, we will act. And Trump was attacking Obama for doing that. Well, I'm not sure it's good to make that kind of threat if you're not going to back it up. But you know, in that kind of case, I think a lot of that stuff came out of, I mean, I don't remember these AEDs, the improvised explosive devices that are put outside of, I don't remember that kind of, I guess you call them landmines, but that kind of thing being used until the Iraq War, and each new technology terrorists come up with, create new stuff. I don't know that there's a simple, there isn't a simple answer. There's not a simple answer with North Korea. I don't think Trump's step, which I think is a positive step, that doesn't mean we've gotten rid of the problem of that. It means we're treating each other as people and bringing humanity to each other. So I can't say, here's what you ought to do in Yemen or here's what you do there. I would say that our military policy, we tend to be very silent about when our allies do some things that are horrific. And in Yemen, I mean, we do have some clout with the Saudi government. The worst humanitarian crisis right now, we ought to be doing that. And the other thing is, chemical weapons are horrific things, but you know, everything else going on in Syria is equally horrific. And I think the one thing I'll say about it is, I think we can be a good example and try to really be on the right side of things rather than trying to, we're done with the Cold War. We should be done with the Cold War. We shouldn't have to do this because strategically we think this is going to tilt the world in our favor because we're long past it. But I can't give you a great answer on the rest of it. Over there, yes.
Do you feel like the policies that we've had in El Salvador, Honduras and Guatemala we are now reaping
what we sold 20 years earlier?
At our border with the asylum seekers, because we supported, we provided arms, and we stabilized those governments over the years with our policies. And now the asylum seekers come to us because we've destabilized them, basically, and made
right.
The country uninhabitable for people that don't want to be involved in the violence. And now
we're
getting them at our borders and we're turning them away.
That's a very important point because, again, when we wonder how come all these people are fleeing, the first thing to say is saying we're arresting all these people when some of them are under international law and humanitarian crisis. We're supposed to be accepting them. Chasing people who are fleeing is as horrific as what we did in World War II when we denied that Stockholm, the ship with 900 Jewish folks coming here. And just for those of you who have some access to outside news, there were some recent documents released this week, I think, from Anne Frank's stuff about how the family had apparently tried to flee. They had tried to get to the U.S. and tried to get to Cuba, and their visas and stuff were denied. I mean, we wouldn't have the Anne Frank horrific story if we had not done that. What we did in World War II, denying people the ability to come here who were fleeing for their lives, we got the same thing happening in El Salvador. But yeah, your point, in the 1970s, 1980s, we tended to pick the repressive governments. I mean, 1954, we installed the repressive government in Guatemala. 1970, we did the same in Chile. We've done the same, and we're taking the repressive governments and not saying these aren't complex cases and so on, but we're backing brutal. I mean, the Catholic Church, Archbishop Romero, now has been dead for 25 or 30 years, and you just keep thinking, a priest, an archbishop saying mass being gunned down at the altar by a government we were supporting.
Well, Shah of Iran.
Yeah, Shah of Iran, the same thing. We did this time and time and time again, and we back these folks, and we wonder why they have a violent situation to come to, which is why the world's an interconnected place, and if we don't do something to help in those countries, and again, those cases, Central America, there are cases where we more than anyone are responsible for what happened, and nobody talks about that now, why they're fleeing. Well, they got a terrible country, why don't they fix their country problems? We caused it, so yeah, it's a very good point.
I'm all for a Department of Peace. I'm a little frustrated. I don't see how we get there. There's this argument that I heard when I was in the Air Force that, you know, we must have better, you know, stronger weapon systems. We must develop our B-1 bomber. We must, and there doesn't seem to be the same effort as far as, like what you're talking about, you know. I understand in Iran, before they took the hostages, we didn't have anybody in the embassy that spoke the language. That's what I was told. Now, to me, that is a big, dumb thing. How can we go to a country and not even speak their language?
The brilliant folks behind the intelligence of that, there were actually a lot of stuff that in 1978,
yeah,
Iranian Revolution, about how the CIA had no experts in religion.
Yeah.
Why? Because religion was a past thing. Religion never affected foreign policy.
Oh.
And the Iranian Revolution, all of a sudden, they're begging for experts in...
Exactly.
...in Farsi and languages. They're begging for experts in...
Yeah.
...fundamentalism of various religions and so on. But yeah, it's naivete is incredible. The one thing I wanted to say here is, this morning I was talking about universal healthcare, which people would say is a long shot and not going to happen right now. I actually think that's doable in the next 5-6 years. I don't actually expect this is likely to happen right now. That's why I think we have to be talking about this. I think there are lots of people who do talk about it, but it's always dismissed, again, by people who often have economic incentives to do otherwise, to say, yeah, oh yeah, I mean, it's easy to mock somebody who stands up there without a gun or anything and stands up in front of somebody who's armed and says, look at them, look, they get mowed down. And you can always find pictures of unarmed protesters being killed. I mean, it's not, I mean, it happens with African-American males here. But in military conflicts, you see that happen time and time again. Last year at Holden, Gary Mason, I think he's coming here in a few weeks. He's a Northern Ireland guy who brought two sides together and really started talking to people. And he grew up on one side of the conflict and ended up bringing both sides together. It's easy to ridicule those efforts because you can always see somebody who dies as a result of it.
Yeah.
And of course, we don't say, well, look, this guy's carrying a gun and he got killed too. So it's a long effort to go on it, and how it's going to happen, well, again, the other quote Einstein said is he didn't know with what weapons World War III would be fought. I mean, that's 60 years ago, and he didn't know what weapons we'd be using by that time, space weapons or what and so on. But he said, most assuredly, World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones, meaning we will have destroyed our civilization, we'll be back to the beginnings again. And it really is that important. And that's one of the frustrations, how few politicians are willing to talk, because they don't want to be soft on military things. They don't want to be seen as weak.
Right.
And best illustration of that I'll give is John Kerry, who came back from Vietnam. His reason for getting involved in politics was he was a Vietnam veteran, was burned by the war and angry at it. He gave away his medals. He was so disgusted. That's why he got in politics in 2004 when he ran for president, 3 years after 9/11. You wouldn't have known where he came from. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons he didn't have a chance of winning, because here's a peace advocate who's going out there saying, the problem with the war isn't that we shouldn't be fighting, it's that George Bush doesn't know how to fight it right. I know how to fight the war right, I can outdo it. And he said he was going to hunt down and kill Osama bin Laden. you know, I think it was easy in the public eye, the waffle ads, to say, hey, this is a guy that's a peace activist, he's doing it. I don't think he really believed what he was saying when he was running for president. He knew you couldn't be a peace activist because people were so scared after 9/11. Well, you know, even from day one of the Iraq War, the country's opinion was 50-50 split,
right,
whether it should be a war. It was not a 80% or 90% or 99% is perhaps during World War II. It was split right down the middle, but I can't be soft on this. Instead, if he said, you know, I'm this guy, fought good, I got all these medals for bravery, but I don't think we should be doing this. I don't think George Bush won the election. I think John Kerry lost it because he wasn't true to who he was. But they're that scared of talking about peace because somehow, oh, everybody's in favor of peace, yeah. Everybody's in favor. Remember, they were going to name I don't remember how many years ago they were going to name the battleship Corpus Christi, the body of Christ.
Yeah.
And it's very sick approach, but people and politicians are scared to talk about peace. So.
I've been disappointed since the Vietnam War that the church hasn't spoken more about nonviolence and in favor of peace as a approach for our government. Because we've got lots of reasons to do that, many of which you have stated. We had a practice somewhat of honoring people that were conscientious objectors.
Thanks for closing this.
And the early church was known to be conscientious objectors. They wouldn't fight in wars, many of them anyway. And we've been totally silent on this subject since the Vietnam War ended.
Other than a handful of peace churches, Mennonites and a Baptist tradition, folks, the church at large has been very, very quiet on it.
But I don't think we church people can justifiably complain about the government.
Because we're not vocal ourselves.
We're not taking the lead here.
Right. And there's occasional statements of some, but it's kind of like during the immigration crisis. It takes separation of little kids from their parents and an intentional policy of doing it before people say, hey, this is wrong. And then all of a sudden everybody says, this is wrong. But everything leading up to it wasn't. And with military things, no, I think it's sad. I think you make a good point.
So I had a question. Are you familiar with the writings and concept of civilian-based defense? This is a technique that uses some of the same things you're talking about, nonviolent action and so on, in order to defend the country from foreign invasions and internal attacks, okay? And I have the book on it, my book on it here and stuff like that, this was written about 25 years ago. And people have been talking about this since the 50s.
Right.
A lot of it was motivated by a nuclear war going on like that. Yeah. But the basic idea is that we eliminate our military forces and instead we train the populace, people, to institute these nonviolent, non-cooperation activities to an invader that would come into the country, and in that way prevent them from accomplishing their goals. They wouldn't be able to profit from an invasion here. So anyway, it's a real alternative to kind
of
military
action. And I think it's the same kind of thing that some of these groups are clearly doing. The peace groups that are out there putting people on the line without arms to accompany people and so on. Witness for Peace in Central America was doing similar things.
Right.
But yeah, that's huge.
So anyway, this is Gene Sharp, and his website is the Einstein Institute. And he never got the memo about how to make a lot of money selling books and so on. So he has a copy of this in PDF form out there, and it's readily available like that.
It seems to me it's less about war versus peace, and it is about where's the money. I mean, nobody gets rich waging peace.
Right.
And until we...
Defense contractors have not been paid to not...
make obscene amounts of money. And, you know, we know who controls much of our government. until we have some kind of control over the influence of money and on our political system, I just don't, I mean, it seems it all comes back to that, no matter what you're looking at.
Maybe I should do one of my talks next week on that, because, yeah, we talked about that with healthcare this morning. It's true. I mean, the money driving the system is what makes our decisions. If somebody gave me an article this morning, The Atlantic had an article on Paul Manafort and how very huge article, it's worth reading, it's in the library, I put it back when I was done with it, but horrific to see how, in his case, I mean, how he basically was helping the Ukrainian president who got overthrown, and just, he paid millions of dollars, extremely wealthy guy, by doing all these things, representing the worst governments and bringing, helping them create a veneer of acceptability to get help here. I mean, the lobbying, foreign lobbyists, it's against the law for 60, 70 years now, but prosecuting people on that, they ought to be. He was unregistered as a foreign influence peddler, and he was. But huge, the money involved in all this, yeah, why do we make decisions on what weapon systems we have? Well, members of Congress who represent those states or whatever, they fight for bigger contracts.
And worse than that, I mean, that kind of money can create something like Fox News, which then takes over the dialogue and logic, you know, that the rest of us are used to.
Clearly, the money in our system is driving a lot of these, not a logic of how we invest people. Over here, we hear the deck.
With the divisions in our own country and the need to bring people more together in a conversation, do you think having a national year of service it would be necessarily in the army, but just having a national year of service like they do in other
countries,
Germany, I think, does it. Do you think that would help us to see each other more as people?
National Year of Service, I think, is a great idea, whether it should be a mandatory thing or not. I mean, it seems to me if we ever had a draft again, that is an alternative, would be a smart way to go. And I do favor encouraging it. The trouble is young people who, I mean, there's several people here who I think are going into Lutheran Volunteer Corps and other things. But so many students have so much debt, they're struggling to do that. The thing I thought you were going to mention, and I think it relates to what you're saying in terms of the lack of civility here, again, the same thing, the way you treat other people, treating them with civility, treating them with respect and dignity, even if you disagree with somebody, even if you think they're, I mean, Donald Trump, I don't think I can say a nice thing about him. I think he's just a very sick person. But having said that, you know, what he did in North Korea thing was a lot better than what he was talking about doing 6 months earlier. Mm-hmm. And spending our time saying how vicious and sick and everything else he is doesn't get us anywhere. Trying to not respond in kind and trying to talk with people. We're called to love our enemies, which is certainly means love our political opponents too. And this kind of nonviolent behavior is good on a personal one-on-one relationship in a country that's torn into two warring factions.
I have to say, though, about Donald Trump, to quote my father, even a blind hog fights an acorn once in a while.
Yes. Yeah, maybe, but whatever. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to be able to check a box on my Form 1040 income tax return, my money, not going to support it.
There are groups who do that. It's usually illegal to do, I mean, who say, I'm going to withhold my income taxes before. I know a handful of people, one of whom has been to Holden in the past, who intentionally keep their income so low they don't pay any federal income taxes, which is a hard thing to do. But people who want to do that, the difficulty, everybody says, well, I don't want to pay for this, I'm not going to pay for that. And everybody thinks the thing, I mean, military is the biggest chunk of our budget. I mean, it's huge.
It's over 50%.
It's absolutely huge and so on, but I share the sentiment. I don't want my money spent that way, but yes. A couple more, we have one more minute, so go ahead.
I think our biggest issue right now is China. you can talk about these small wars that are going on that are nipping us in the ankle all the time. They're nipping us in the ankle all the time, but the Chinese are getting into our pockets, and they're getting a pool of all the natural resources in the world. Their goal is to control the whole world, not just to control the Southeast Asia area. They control the Southeast Asia area now. They want the rest of it. I've traveled back and forth from Asia for the past 18 years, and I have seen what's going on. I've traveled into China for 3 years, and I traveled into the Philippines, and this is where my kids were born, and my wife is from the Philippines. And they've got a stranglehold in that whole area, in the South China Sea right now.
I will agree with you. China may be the biggest threat in terms of size, number of people, in terms of money. They will be the biggest economy in the world soon. They are quickly catching up and will be overtaking us. I'm not sure the trade war we're in the middle of right now is a good thing to do. I don't think that necessarily escalates into anything else, but it certainly isn't necessarily going to get there. But I think the one thing I say about your comment is, yes, I'm very afraid of China's intent and so on, very concerned about Russian intent. I mean, interfering with elections and so on, very concerned with what's happening in Turkey. I can give you a lot of those may be smaller and so on, but big picture is we should be trying to find ways. The United Nations is there for a purpose. Yeah. We should be trying to back it and trying to help it.
When Kennedy started the Peace Corps, right. He meant for that to catapult into maybe a half a million individuals going out helping other countries. Right. And then he was assassinated.
Right. So that's the whole thing. I mean, the Peace Corps, those ideas need to be supported, not be criticized. But yes.
All China has to do is to quit buying our tea bills, and we're done.
One last time,
Martin Luther King is probably the most visible architect of peaceful resistance. Nonetheless, he still had people in his group that, when he did his marches, wanted to use violent means. He had a hard time keeping them back.
That's right? One of the hardest struggles for nonviolent organizers. Gandhi had the same fight. I mean, you always have people who, because they're not your, they don't have to follow you. They can do whatever they want. We think you're too timid. We want to do this different approach. Right. It's definitely there. In any case, I hope this is at least food for thought I think a lot of you already like this kind of direction, but the idea we ought to be talking about, and when people say nonviolence doesn't work, neither does war by those same measures. And trying to recognize what I think we recognize is how dangerous the world becomes, especially when our only solution is to poke a stick in the eye of people who are mad at us already and get them more mad. With that, thank you for coming. I'll be around if you want to.